Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com. And today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the president finally answering the question today of whether he worked for Russia, where instead he attacked the FBI agents assigned by the acting FBI director to do the investigation into him following Trump's firing of Comey, with Trump calling these FBI agents known scoundrels and dirty cops. We will investigate what seems more than a coincidence that along with McCabe, it has been Peter Strzok, Lisa Page and Bruce Orr, who Trump has hounded and purged in concert with Fox News' vilification of them. A former 16-year veteran of the FBI who specialized in domestic terrorism and covert operations, Michael German, a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice's Liberty and National Security Program, joins us to discuss whether Trump's desperate efforts to shoot the messengers in the hope of stopping the message will end up being futile since the Mueller investigation appears close to issuing a report. And since Comey did not act in a more timely and transparent manner in 2015 and 2016, as the FBI learned of Russian meddling in our election, together with raising last-minute pre-election doubts about Hillary Clinton, we'll look into the current credibility competition as the American people are asked to contrast the integrity of the Boy Scout above reproach public servant with the lying, money-grubbing, amoral grifter who Comey, along with the Russians, helped elect. Then, with the increasingly likely possibility that the American people will soon be faced with evidence that their president is both a criminal and a traitor, we will examine the expectations that there will be a clamoring for payback against Russia for hacking our democracy with a call to increase sanctions. Michael Carpenter, a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense who previously served as a foreign policy advisor to Vice President Joe Biden and as Director for Russia at the National Security Council, joins us to discuss mounting evidence of Trump's guilt and Michael Carpenter's article at the National Interest, How to Make Sanctions on Russia Work. Then finally, with teachers in the nation's second-largest school district, Los Angeles, going on strike today, we will explore this nationwide battle against the encroachment of charter schools and the underfunding of public education following earlier strikes in Arizona, West Virginia, North Carolina, Oklahoma, and Kentucky. Eric Blank, a former high school teacher and author of Red State Revolt, The Teacher Strike Wave and Working Class Politics, joins us to discuss his article at The Guardian, LA's Teachers Can Teach the Working Class About the Power of Labor Strikes, and another at The Nation, LA's Teacher Strike Will Be the Toughest Yet. And joining us now is Michael German, a fellow with the Brennan Center for Justice at Liberty and National Security Program, where his work focuses on law enforcement and intelligence oversight and reform. Previously, he served as the Policy Counsel for National Security and Privacy for the American Civil Liberties Union Washington Legislative Office and is a 16-year veteran of federal law enforcement, having served as a special agent with the FBI, where he specialized in domestic terrorism and covert operations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael German.
Thanks very much for having me.
And it's an extraordinary thing, Michael, to see the President of the United States asked whether or not he is effectively working for the other side, for the Russians. And he initially was asked that question by a friendly interviewer on Fox. He didn't answer it. He got indignant and said that's the most insulting question I've ever heard. But then he did actually answer the question today. And he said, I never worked for Russia. And then not only did I never work for Russia, I think it's a disgrace that you even asked that question because it's a whole big fat hoax. It's just a hoax. Well, we heard that, of course, any number of times. But what I found extraordinary was that he then turned his attention or his ire to the FBI again and basically attacked those FBI counterintelligence officials who were asked to investigate Trump after he fired Comey. He referred to them as known scoundrels and dirty cops. As an ex-FBI man, how does that feel to have the President of the United States call members of your previous work colleagues scoundrels and dirty cops?
Certainly, it's terribly inappropriate for the chief executives of the United States to be calling his own employees in the executive branch dirty cops and certainly doesn't have the factual basis to make an allegation like that. But, you know, part of the problem here is the FBI as an institution and the particular individuals who were running the FBI during the campaign had some behaviors that were outside of policy and practice at the FBI, and I think created an atmosphere where it's easy to suggest that they were acting for improper means. That doesn't justify what the president does by any means, but I think that's what has led us to where we are today, where institutions are being challenged rather than just individuals.
Right, but he has attacked a certain group of individuals for a long time, particularly, of course, Comey. And he said before
right.
that Comey was a bad cop. He was a dirty cop. But now that this New York Times story has broken about how shortly after the firing of Comey, the FBI top officials, and obviously with Comey gone, the acting director, Andrew McCabe, was in charge, and they were faced with the possibility that there was an obstruction of justice, and they'd seen Trump have the Russian ambassador and foreign minister in the Oval Office, where he gave them top secret information. That had to alarm them. So they launched this counterintelligence investigation. It's hardly a coincidence, Mark German, that all of the people that were tasked to do that counterintelligence investigation into Trump's possible ties to the Kremlin are the very people that Trump has purged and hounded out of the FBI and that Fox News has vilified. Peter Strzok, the FBI lawyer Lisa Page, Bruce Orr, and, of course, Andrew McCabe.
It's particularly ironic given that the overreach that Comey and his colleagues were involved in during the campaign in investigating Hillary Clinton and repeatedly going beyond Department of Justice policy in discussing an investigation that didn't result in an indictment and making disparaging comments about Secretary Clinton's behavior, certainly in some analysts' minds had actually helped Trump get elected in the first place, and that overreach was going on with regard to one candidate when it appears the FBI was very slow to react to the allegations of Russian meddling in the election. I think it's hard to imagine how less aggressive they could have been. I mean, there were plenty of articles going back long before the campaign even started discussing Donald Trump's business relationships and associations with shadowy Russian oligarchs and others and other activities that indicated perhaps some FBI supervision of what was going on would have been appropriate, and yet that the FBI waited until after the election to actually begin that investigation in earnest seems quite troubling to me. If the FBI actually claims to be an intelligence agency, as it does now, primarily an intelligence agency, how they didn't see this threat on the horizon years before is hard to square.
And the threat, in a nutshell, is a kind of, as the Soviet Union collapsed, the Soviet organized crime, the Vori, built a bridgehead through Brighton Beach and other American cities for Russian organized crime and as a front for Russian intelligence, as the KGB looted the Soviet coffers and laundered a lot of that money through Manhattan real estate. That in itself, the idea that they didn't notice at the time in the mid-80s and through the end of the collapse of the Soviet Empire, they didn't notice this deadly fusion between Russian organized crime and intelligence?
Certainly it was noticed, and whether the FBI reacted as an institution to that threat thoroughly enough, I think, is the question. Clearly there were numerous cases brought over that time period. but they seem to be at a lower level, and particularly after 9/11, when counterterrorism became the number one priority, the lack of focus on where true national security threats actually existed became part of the problem, and I think blinded us to threats that we should have easily seen, because these were being picked up in the media. They were being picked up by other agencies, other agents working inside the organization, and yet the priority was all being put to counterterrorism.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael German, who is a fellow with the Brennan Center for Justice's Liberty and National Security Program. Previously served as the Policy Counsel for National Security and Privacy for the American Civil Liberties Union Washington Legislative Office, and is a 16-year veteran of federal law enforcement, having served as a special agent with the FBI, where he specialized in domestic terrorism and covert operations. So fast forward then to Comey. When the Russians start hacking, et cetera, one of the things that came up there that was pretty extraordinary was the kind of lackadaisical way the FBI informed the DNC that they were being hacked. Now, there's no excusing the incompetence of the DNC and of Podesta's tech people allowing a Russian phishing expedition to become the hack of all of his emails. So there's plenty of blame to be apportioned with Democratic right. Party incompetence. But why was the FBI so casual about informing the DNC, which, by the way, a message that they never got?
I think it's hard to understand. And according to the reporting, that the first time the FBI noticed this, they simply called the help desk. And the person working at the DNC help desk said, you know, I received this phone call from somebody who said they were in the FBI, and I didn't even believe that it was real. And all it did was warn them to check their servers. So clearly there was a slow reaction to what was a gathering threat. And even aside from the hacking, allied intelligence agencies, going back to 2015, were warning the FBI that Russian intelligence people were meeting with people orbiting the Trump campaign. So there should have been ample warning that there was something amiss here. And even going back before that, I mean, you have somebody like Paul Manafort. If you look at what he has been convicted of, these were crimes going back a decade or more, whether it's the bank fraud with his associations with these foreign actors. Now we're understanding we're associated with Russian intelligence. And but just the idea that an American political consultant can go interact with these foreign actors of these hostile foreign nations and come back with tens of millions of dollars without raising some concerns in the intelligence and law enforcement community, I think shows how our hyper focus on counterterrorism perhaps obstructed our view of greater threats.
And, of course, there was an awful lot of FBI white-collar agents taken away from looking at Wall Street, was there not, to get into counterterrorism after 9/11. And we paid a price for that with the Wall Street crash.
Exactly. When you look back, and the FBI was claiming that it was transitioning to become primarily a domestic intelligence agency, there were agents within the FBI, most notably Chris Swecker, who ran the white-collar crime program in the FBI, who said, hey, you know, as early as 2004, we're seeing this increasing mortgage fraud, and this is going to impact the economy. And yet the FBI management decided we are not going to change our priorities, and resources weren't devoted to the problem. And by 2009, the director of national intelligence is going before Congress saying the number one threat to our nation's security is the global financial meltdown. So again, if you're an intelligence agency, you should be looking at threats on the horizon rather than throwing resources at the past threat and blinding yourself to current threats.
So how are we then to navigate here through this period where it's likely that there'll be some big shoes to drop with the Mueller inquiry, and the walls seem to be closing in on Trump, and we may well find out right. some incredibly damning information. So I guess my question, though, is at this point, if we have to choose between who has the most integrity and honesty and who should we support, James Comey or Donald Trump, why is it that the people in Trump's base have a problem with Comey and not with Trump?
Well, I think part of the problem is that the way governmental institutions have been chiseled away over the last 15, 16 years, particularly the intelligence establishment, that it creates this distrust of institutions and this instead looking for a person of integrity that we can put all our faith in because we can no longer trust the institutions of our government. And that's where we get into this fallacy of we have to trust Comey was the doing the appropriate thing, or that Trump is the one doing the appropriate thing. Both can be wrong. They both can be acting for improper purposes at the same time, and that doesn't get us anywhere by saying one is all good and the other is all bad. What we have to do is look to see how our institutions were eroded and how we can reestablish the divided government and the separation of powers to ensure that each agency is correcting and checking the others to make sure that we have public access to information. And that's really the key. You know, so much of what our government does today is behind closed doors. And, you know, as we're seeing in this investigation, that allows any number of conspiracy theorists to come up with their own versions of reality. And that's what harms our country more than if we can actually just get the information to the public and let the public decide.
Well, just in closing, of course, one of the greatest embarrassments to the FBI was the Hansen Soviet agent who was actually quite close to Louis Freeh. They were both members of Opus Dei, and he did an enormous amount of damage. There are rumors, Michael German, that the Mueller investigation is wary of the FBI's New York office because they think there might be a mole working for the Russians. Is that possible, do you think, that you'd think after the Hansen thing they would have really cleaned house, although I guess moles are moles, right?
Right, and I would be surprised if not that there isn't a mole working for some hostile foreign government. That's part and parcel of all intelligence activities. It happens from time to time. But, you know, I think the concerns with the New York office were the leaks from the Clinton investigation that were so damaging during the campaign. And the inspector general is actually conducting an investigation of that. So we should get more transparency on that issue as well. But sure, that certainly, you know, combines into this whole ball of wax,
right,
about how do you trust any of these people when everybody seems to be working from their own agenda rather than from serving the public the way the public deserves to be served.
Right, but just in closing on that, the issue you just brought up, Mike German, that looks like Giuliani may have had his fingerprints on all of that stuff. Could somebody, a former U.S. attorney, have that kind of influence over the New York FBI office?
I'm not sure that he would have influence over the New York office, but certainly, you know, the FBI is made up of a cross-section of America. It happens to be a very white and very male cross-section. So if you look at the political candidates that might white males most likely support in the country, you'd see that there were likely a lot of Trump supporters in the FBI. And, you know, that shouldn't be a surprise to anyone. These are fellow Americans just like anybody else. But obviously, when you have an investigation and leaks or purported leaks coming from that investigation being discussed on the news every day, that creates a problem for the integrity of that investigation. And, you know, clearly, when we look at the decisions that James Comey and Andrew McCabe were making, a lot of them seem to be driven by the press coverage and their own press coverage rather than by the public interest.
Well, Michael German, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael German, who's a fellow with the Brennan Center for Justice at Liberty and National Security Program. Previously, he served as the Policy Counsel for National Security and Privacy for the American Civil Liberties Union Washington Legislative Office and is a 16-year veteran of federal law enforcement, where he served as a special agent with the FBI, specializing in domestic terrorism and covert operations. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with more of Background Briefing on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Dr. Michael Carpenter, a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense, who previously served in the White House as a foreign policy advisor to Vice President Joe Biden and as Director for Russia at the National Security Council. Now a Senior Director of the Biden Center for Diplomacy and Global Engagement at the University of Pennsylvania, he has an article at the National Interest, How to Make Sanctions on Russia Work. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Michael Carpenter.
Thanks. Nice to be with you again.
Well, thank you, Michael. And obviously, it's an extraordinary situation to have, one, a friendly journalist ask Trump whether he is in any way compromised by Russia. And, of course, he didn't answer the question to Jeanine Pirro on Fox, just said it was a terribly insulting question. But he did actually answer the question today. And let's start with that. I mean, are we not at an amazing point where our own president has to be asked whether or not he's loyal to the United States or to Putin?
Absolutely. I mean, it's just astounding that our Federal Bureau of Investigation had reasons, good reasons, for launching an investigation of the president of the United States to see whether he might be a willing or unwitting agent of a foreign power. I mean, it's just amazing that we're at this stage. But, of course, we've suspected this for some time, so it's not altogether surprising, but it's still astounding.
So your piece in the National Interest, How to Make Sanctions on Russia Work, if indeed we are on track here for some extraordinary revelation from the Mueller investigation, which I don't think is much of a reach. I mean, there's an enormous number of books that have been written about Trump's history with Russia going back to the mid-80s with the Vori, the Russian organized crime. They spent up to at least $100 million buying condos in Trump Tower. You've got Seth Hettner's book. You've got Craig Unger's book. Greg Miller at The Post, who broke the story just yesterday of how Trump has gone to extraordinary lengths to suppress any records of his meetings with Putin. So that's all out there. My sense is that your article about sanctions is very important. One, it explains why they're not working particularly well now. But two, don't you think that when the truth comes out, whether it's a Manchurian candidate scenario or something less, nevertheless, won't there be a clamor on the part of American citizens to do something?
I think there will be, absolutely. I think that whatever Mueller comes up with in his final report regarding a potential criminal conspiracy between the president's team or his campaign team and Russian intelligence officers, there was at a minimum a 20-year or more history of Trump connections to various Russian or, better said, Eurasian organized crime figures that is deeply troubling and cause for concern, and is really at the heart of this whole Trump-Russia saga. And so, you know, you go back to the mid-80s when Donald Trump was being courted by Soviet diplomats in the United States, and when at a time when Russian organized crime figures were trying to gain a foothold here, primarily in New York City, but also in L.A. and other parts of the U.S., Denver, Miami, a few other cities. And Trump, the Trump organization and Trump properties were very much at the heart of that effort to launder money and to gain inroads into American society. And I just think that whatever Mueller comes out with, he will expose that side of Trump's relationship with Russia, which is cause for concern, quite apart from any quid pro quo regarding hacking and illegal activities during the campaign itself, which, of course, there is good reason to believe that there is fire behind the smoke. I mean, after all, let's just recall the very simple fact that President Trump's campaign manager, his campaign chairman, Paul Manafort, had a consulting company in Ukraine for which he had on his payroll a known GRU, that's Russian military intelligence officer, Konstantin Kalimnik, working there. This is a guy, in fact, he didn't just work there, he ran the company. So if you're looking for connections to Russian intelligence, you really don't have to go any further than that key connection between Paul Manafort, the campaign chairman, and this guy, Konstantin Kalimnik. And then you can spin off all the various other connections, which are, in my view, less important, Carter Page and Roger Stone and all the others. But this is really at the heart of the campaign. So I think it will be very much a bombshell when it comes out. We'll have to see the details. But there will be a clamor, I think, for sanctions. And that's why the piece I wrote, that's why I wanted to get it out there on the record. I think both the Obama administration and this administration have not really imposed serious sanctions on Russia. And so I tried to explain what serious sanctions would entail and give sort of the layperson an understanding of why the steps, the measures that we've taken so far are really underwhelming.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Michael Carpenter, who's a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense, who previously served in the White House as a foreign policy advisor to Vice President Joe Biden and as Director for Russia at the National Security Council, now a Senior Director of the Biden Center for Diplomacy and Global Engagement at the University of Pennsylvania. He has an article at the National Interest, How to Make Sanctions on Russia Work. So, just looking at Putin's Russia in terms of this extraordinary possibility of our president, and we saw it actually, the whole world saw it at the press conference after the meeting that took place between Putin and Trump in Helsinki, of course, for which there is no record, and that in itself is pretty alarming. But then the way that he handled the questions, particularly questions relating to Russia's involvement in the elections, any normal American president would have taken that opportunity and turned to Putin and said, yes, you did do it, and you better not do it again. So something happened there that has even led people like the former head of the CIA to suggest that there's a threshold of treason involved in this. But if this
and
is,
by the way, the former head of the Mossad as well has suggested the very same thing.
Right.
It's not just Americans who see this.
Sure.
Our partners overseas, including
right.
savvy people who worked in foreign intelligence services, see the very same thing.
And the former DNI has said that he thinks that Putin is Trump's case officer. So these are pretty alarming statements. So if this is true, then this would be the greatest intelligence operation since the Germans put Lenin in a boxcar in 1917 and sent him to Russia. But on the other hand, you've got to see this in the context, surely, if it's true, and it looks like it's true, of hybrid warfare, which Putin has developed. I don't think Putin cared one way or another if Trump was elected. Had he not been elected, he would be running around the country leading rallies against Hillary Clinton's presidency, leading the chant of lock her up, lock her up. Obviously, if he's got his guy in the White House, he can do an awful lot of damage, and nobody can argue that the United States under the Trump administration has not been just an unending, unyielding example of incompetence and chaos. But I see it also in terms of the hybrid warfare notion that you can, below the threshold of kinetic warfare, you can do an awful lot. And it would seem like Putin has done an awful lot to this country, simply essentially manipulating us against each other.
No, that's absolutely right. I think that Putin would have been happy with Trump on the outside trying to tear down the system, as you said, with rallies, by declaring the 2016 election illegitimate had he not won. But, of course, he much prefers to have Trump in the Oval Office because all of Trump's policies have been pro-Russian policies, whether it be his policy of neglect with regards to Ukraine, whether it be his withdrawal from Syria, whether it be his fawning praise for Putin, his lack of willingness to acknowledge that Russia interfered with the last presidential election. All of these things are, Trump is essentially mouthing Kremlin talking points. And so they very much support Vladimir Putin's goals in this country. But as I said, Putin would be happy with just simply the chaos that that Trump creates and that this administration has unleashed in this country, because that is ultimately what this hybrid warfare is about. It's about using non-kinetic, asymmetric methods to include cyber attacks, to include disinformation, to include the deployment of dark money to gain influence, as is alleged happened, for example, with the NRA, but also with other elements of the sort of right-wing, alt-right apparatus. These are all sort of methods, covert methods usually, that produce either influence or that produce chaos, that produce divisions within our society. And that's very much Putin's MO. I think he realizes that his military interventions in Georgia and Ukraine have actually been rather counterproductive because they've turned the populations of those two countries against Russia. And so I think he's realized over time that he's far more effective when he uses subterfuge and what are called active measures in Russian intelligence jargon to try to subvert Western societies from the inside. Because that's cheap, it's fairly effective when done well, and hard to attribute to the originator, to Russia. And so he's really doubled down on these active measures, both in the United States but also in Europe. And I think it'll continue. He sees the Trump project as his most successful project of all, in my opinion.
And another aspect of the Trump project, of course, is the Bannon project, which is what's going on in Western Europe.
Yeah, which are very much one and the same.
Yeah.
Putin's ultimate objectives are to delegitimize, if possible, break up the NATO alliance, to sow dissensus within the European Union. Brexit is therefore very much a core element of his agenda in Europe. And his support for people like Nigel Farage and the Brexiteers is and Steve Bannon over here in the United States is very much all part of one piece. These are all people who think in similar ways. Of course, Bannon and Farage had a close friendship, Farage and Trump. Have and continue a close friendship and a close relationship. So this is part of a campaign to delegitimize supranational institutions and alliances like the EU and NATO and try and break up these countries within Europe, including our own country, but also take a look at, for example, Russia's efforts in tandem with Venezuela to support the secession of Catalonia from Spain. Again, it's an attempt to break up a European country and peel it off from the European Union. It's
right.
Astounding, really, how far this goes.
Sure. I was just going to add to the Brexit tears, Arron Banks, the insurance magnate in the UK whose Russian wife is rumored to have connections to the FSB. He largely financed Brexit. And we don't know exactly with whose money that happened, but Farage and Arron Banks were among the first to show up to congratulate Trump in Trump Tower after his election in November 2016. So
yeah, and the Arron Banks story is really quite illuminating, and it's just astounding that this hasn't been the subject of a formal UK inquiry along the lines of the Mueller investigation. Because here's a guy whose wealth is largely unexplained, and in fact, it's not clear that he really is as wealthy as he claims to be, yet who gave millions and millions of pounds to the Leave campaign, and who had multiple contacts with known Russian intelligence operatives at the embassy, at the Russian embassy in London. And yet, somehow, this support, this dark money that went into the Brexit campaign, and these various connections, very dodgy connections with Russian operatives, are being brushed aside, and the UK is going ahead with the current plans from the Tory government of Theresa May. It's really astounding. But it's all, again, it's all part of this campaign by Vladimir Putin to try to sow dissensus and to break up NATO and the EU.
So just in the last few minutes, turning to your article at the National Interest, Michael Carpenter, How to Make Sanctions on Russia Work, you point out the blowback from kinetic warfare, both in Ukraine and in Georgia. And in effect, Putin's limited in any military moves towards the West, both in Ukraine and in the Balkans, I think, because of the real possibility of the Russian army getting bogged down in guerrilla warfare. And he's got a very low-cost situation now, having shut down Ukraine's ports on the east in Mariupol, because you can't get insurance to go under that bridge. You have to have smaller ships. So by holding a few gunboats of the Ukrainian Navy hostage with their crew, he's done a lot. But my sense is that when you talk about sanctions in the context of punishing him, what we're learning now from this White House, which we just learned yesterday, is about John Bolton asking the Pentagon for war plans to attack Iran. If at the end of the day, the thing that really hurts Putin is economic sanctions, we know that he's a one-resource economy, which is oil and gas. So if the price of oil goes up, Putin can steal more, him and the Siloviki can steal more and keep the Russian people bribed to some extent. If the price of oil goes down, that's when he's vulnerable. So if the U.S. were to be involved in an attack on Iran, surely the price of oil would go through the roof and Putin would be just, you know.
Oh, he'd be thrilled. He'd be absolutely delighted if this administration chose to attack Iran, which would, it would divert attention away from Russia. It would do all the things that you just said regarding driving the price of oil up. It would be a boon for the Russian budget. It would be absolutely in keeping with Putin's interests. So you're absolutely right also about Putin's desire for asymmetric advantage against Western countries. He knows that the Russian military can't hold a candle in a conventional military sense to NATO and the NATO militaries from Western Europe to the United States. So he has looked for advantages where he can in the asymmetric realm, especially cyber, disinformation, dark money. Those are the three main tools that he uses to try and subvert Western democracies. And the thing is that we actually have our own asymmetric advantage over Russia that we could deploy if we chose to do so, and that is financial sanctions against Russia. But curiously, the United States and our West European allies have simply chosen not to go there. It's astounding, really, when you think about it. We have this massive financial cudgel that we could use to great effect if we wanted to, but we simply have chosen not to use it. And so, as I explain in the article, it doesn't take a lot of very complex financial understanding to come to grips with the fact that if we applied full blocking sanctions on Russian banks, in other words, if we prohibited Russian banks from conducting transactions using the dollar in the U.S. financial system, we could bring their economy to a halt. And it doesn't require that we sanction all of their banks at once. We could do this in a piecemeal fashion, starting with some of the smaller banks and then working our way up a list progressively to larger and larger banks until the pain was great enough that whatever objective we wanted to achieve, we would at least have some real negotiating leverage in order to achieve that aim. But it's just astounding that we have chosen not to use this lever in our dealings with Russia. And so we've sort of ceded the ground to them in this asymmetric hybrid warfare that we're currently engaged in.
Well, just in closing, though, obviously the Russian people, a lot of them, they must know that they're being the country's being looted by Putin and his cronies. The young certainly appear to know it. But there is, of course, a lot of patriotism there, a lot of delusion because of state-controlled media. And how do you deal with the fact that sanctions are a boon to Putin as an excuse for the looting of the country by saying to the Russian people, you know, we've got to tighten our belts because the West is punishing us and trying to destroy us?
Yeah, I think the Russian population would turn on the authorities awfully quickly if the economy really started to go south. I don't think Putin can sell that line that sanctions are really the result of a Western attack on Russia's sovereignty. I really think his grip on power is very brittle. Most people have unfavorable views of Putin, but of course, when the someone from a polling agency calls them and an unknown person and asks them, "Do you support Vladimir Putin?" Of course, they're going to say yes. I mean, this is a country that lived through more than 75 years of Soviet totalitarianism. People have an ingrained propensity to say whatever the person on the other end of the line wants to hear or what they think they want to hear. So those opinion polls of Putin's popularity don't really convey a fulsome support within Russian society. I think if we applied economic sanctions on Russia, I think the population would start to turn against this leadership. And I don't think the aim should be necessarily regime change, but I do think that we should at least have a little bit more leverage in our negotiations, whether it be over Ukraine or whether it be over Russian interference in our democratic institutions. And we could surely apply that leverage if we wanted to.
Well, Dr. Marco Carpenter, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Michael Carpenter, who's a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense, who previously served in the White House as a foreign policy advisor to Vice President Joe Biden and as Director for Russia at the National Security Council, now a Senior Director of the Biden Center for Diplomacy and Global Engagement at the University of Pennsylvania. He has an article at the National Interest, How to Make Sanctions on Russia Work. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with more of Background Briefing on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com.
From Russia with love I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you. I've traveled the world.
It's just a goodbye. Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by. And feed them on your dreams. The one they picked, the one you know by.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Eric Blank, who's a former high school teacher in the Bay Area who writes on labor movements past and present. He's the author of the new book, Red State Revolt, The Teacher Strike Wave and Working Class Politics. And he has an article at The Guardian, LA Teachers Can Teach the Working Class About the Power of Labor Strikes, as well as another article at The Nation, LA's Teacher Strike Will Be the Toughest Yet. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eric Blank.
Great. It's a privilege to be on.
Well, thank you, Eric. And you've been out in the rain with the teachers. A very, very rainy day here in Los Angeles. First day of the teacher strike, they marched on the Los Angeles Unified School District headquarters. There was a rally downtown, and pickets were set up this morning. I think about 31,000 teachers are involved. Is that right?
Yeah, there's about 33,000 teachers are covered by UTLA. And we know that at least 28,000 were on duty at the picket lines this morning. So it's a huge number. Ironically, or maybe not ironically, if you understand the way the new superintendent, Buettner, works, he's been claiming that there were only 3,500 teachers on strike today. So his method is more or less just to make up whatever facts he deems fit and see what sticks.
Well, it sounds like he's following the Trump playbook, but there have been teacher strikes, of course, in Arizona, West Virginia, Kentucky, and Oklahoma. Why do you say that this teacher strike in Los Angeles that just began today will be the toughest yet?
That's an important question. The strikes that began in West Virginia and then, as you mentioned, through other red states really took people by surprise. They took the politicians by surprise. They took the corporations that are behind these politicians by surprise. And so you didn't really see a very concerted effort of the media and big business to smash the strikes. In Los Angeles, it's a very different dynamic because what the impetus for the current conflict really began in 2017 when billionaires like Eli Broad and Reed Hastings imposed and bought a school board election to put in a charter school majority. And so what that means is that this conflict has really been prepared for years by a very wealthy, very influential sector of the elite. And because of that, the conflict that we're going to see in Los Angeles that we just began today is unlikely to take the same course as the previous strikes. We've already seen a really unprecedented amount of lying, as I mentioned earlier, and legal injunctions. The strike has been delayed for months, really, because of so many injunction after injunction. So they're playing hardball. The good news is that the union is also very strong.
So this is the second largest school district in the country, and this is the first strike in over 30 years. You mentioned the charter school encroachment on education. That's something that's happening around the country, but it's been particularly active here, and it's extraordinary that people vote for these characters that come in with these amazingly expensive election campaigns for a seat on the school board, which normally didn't cost a lot of money, kind of down there in the dog catcher category. But billions and billions have been raised from these damn charter companies. So if they figure it's cost effective to spend, you know, millions on getting some shill in for them into the school system to privatize, they must be seeing piles of money at the end of the rainbow.
Yeah, the it's not an accident that you have some of the wealthiest, really capitalists in the country, people like Eli Broad, Reed Hastings is the founder of Netflix. They understand that public education is the last major public service provided to people in the United States that's accessible to all. And so because of that, it's understandable that they're going after education. And the stakes of what we're seeing here is simple. There's a plan that's basically public at this point by Buettner and the corporations and the charters behind them to massively downsize and essentially destroy the Los Angeles school district, break it up into competing networks with the goal of 50, 60, 70, up to 90% private charter schools, privately run charter schools. So, yeah, there's major financial real estate prospects at the end of the line if they win. But at this point, the major obstacle to that are, of course, the teachers and the students and the parents that are supporting them.
But let's zero in on what it is they actually want, these billionaires, the head of Netflix and Eli Broad, the one that every, you know, he's the sort of guru of the art world that everybody sucks up to. But, he, you know, he's already meddled in the Detroit school system, and it's a catastrophe as a result of that. What do they want to do? Do they want to just basically privatize and turn education into a for-profit business like these phony for-profit colleges that steal about $40 billion in taxpayer money or squander about $40 billion in taxpayer money per year and give kids worthless diplomas and saddle them with a lifetime of debt? What is their end goal here?
Well, the end goal is to downsize public education and for the benefit of private charters.
But what does that mean, though? I mean, qui bono? I'm trying to find out who benefits, because do we end up with a bunch of kids being prepared for a life in corporate America? Do we end up with a bunch of phony shingled schools just ripping off people? What is the vision of these meddling billionaires?
Right. The meddling billionaires, as you put it, really what they'd like to see is a few things. One is, and this shouldn't be underestimated, they want to see the destruction of labor unions. And so one of the major differences of the charters and the regular public schools is that more or less at charters, it's much harder, if not impossible, to organize unions. And so what that means is labor costs, working conditions are more favorable to workers in public schools as opposed to charters. And so this is a major, not secondary, impetus for all people like Eli Broad or Reed Hastings, who are viciously anti-union, to want to push charters. That's the first. The second is that I do think there's an ideological commitment to what you could call free market fundamentalism. We don't actually know whether Eli Broad will directly profit off of these charters. It's not always clear that there's a one-to-one link between he will be able to make billions off of the privatization of these schools. It's possible. But what's clear is that for this sector of the ruling class that has interest in privatizing, they're convinced that both unions need to be smashed and that the only solution to public education is to make it run like a private corporation. And so that ideological commitment, which is born out of their personal interests, is really driving a lot of the offensive, even if they don't immediately benefit. Some of them will, through real estate deals, through all sorts of different shenanigans. But even when they don't directly benefit, they are still have an interest in really downsizing the public sector and smashing unions.
Well, these billionaires that you mentioned, Eli Broad and Reed Hastings, have installed a fellow billionaire investment banker, Austin Buettner, as a superintendent of schools. They have been in negotiations. Apparently, they've been pretty bitter negotiations so far. What is the issue of the 6.5% raise? Apparently, Buettner has offered 6. So is the issue here about the other part of the demand on the part of the teachers, which is more investment in schools which are underfunded, have huge class sizes, etc.?
Yeah, exactly. This is not a strike primarily about wages or even benefits. The stakes of the struggle, really from both sides, have to do with what we've been talking about already, which is whether the public education will continue to exist in Los Angeles or not. And so the demands of the teachers union really go along that line, more so than the wages, because one of the lines of the union, and that was repeated today by teachers who are picketing and also from speakers at the stage, is what good is a wage increase if we don't even have a school in 2 years? And so the demands that they're raising are primarily, I would say that the major demand and the one that's most widely felt, deeply felt, is the demand for lower class sizes. And Los Angeles schools have currently no cap on class sizes. The district can unilaterally raise them to whatever heights they want, and this goes up to 49 in some classrooms. Really extraordinarily terrible conditions. But precisely class size is so important, because if class size can be brought down and the quality of education can be improved, that, according to teachers and their union, is the single best lever they have at this point to stop this privatization push, because the mechanism through which you would push students out of the public schools and into charters is by making the conditions in your regular schools so onerous and so chaotic and so impossible to learn that parents, understandably would want to take their students elsewhere. And so fighting for the better quality schools is a direct challenge to the privatization plans. And so there's other demands in that along the line for more school nurses, more counselors, for regulations on the charters. These are the other major demands that I think that teachers are walking the line on for today.
So is this going to go on for a long time? I mean, obviously the mayor of Los Angeles is planning on running for president, and there's a rumor that Dianne Feinstein will retire. She's got a new 6-year term, and that the new governor of California, Gavin Newsom, might appoint Garcetti as the U.S. senator from California to help him in his ambitions to be president. Give us a sense of the politics behind this and who are the winners and losers.
Yeah, that's an important question. Obviously, nobody knows. It's possible to say ahead of time. But my sense, and the sense of, I think, most teachers, is that this is not looking like it will be a short strike. It's unlikely that you'll see a deal in the next few days, because Buettner, the superintendent, is clearly playing hardball. He's lying to the press. He's given them nothing. He didn't even show up for negotiations on the last day of negotiations. So clearly from above, they're not inclined to come up with some sort of good faith bargaining attempt or compromise. And so it's really going to be a battle for public opinion and a battle of attrition. My guess is it could last weeks, and it's going to be up to the union to continue doing what it's done so far, which is to make it clear to students and parents that they are the union and the teachers are the force that are fighting for their students. And I think what we're going to expect is both sides are going to be fighting for public opinion. And when that starts to turn one way or the other, you're going to see a huge amount of pressure either on the union or on the district to settle. And it will be at that point you'll see the politicians like Garcetti, Newsom step in, because at this point everybody's sort of waiting to see where the cards fall as far as public opinion.
Well, just in the last minute, it would seem that most of the LAUSD, the schools that still function, are basically serving minority students, that there's been a lot of flight from Los Angeles itself because of housing prices to the suburbs and to the exurbs. And together with this movement towards more and more charter school, which I think appealing off more middle class and white families, those two factors are leading the LAUSD to shrink. So is that a problem, that not enough white people care about the education of brown and black kids?
Yeah, that's an important question. I think that it's very much the case that this strike is, in addition to an education struggle, a racial justice struggle. And that's been a common theme that teachers have talked about and that union leaders have talked about, that really the people who are getting disproportionately hurt by privatization and underfunding is overwhelmingly black and brown communities and working class communities. And so I think that the root of it is maybe not white people in general, because as we saw in Oklahoma, West Virginia, Arizona, where primarily white students and white teachers, there they're facing very similar issues. So I think that that being said, in the context of California, it's clear that the attacks have a disproportionate effect and really are a form of structural racism against black and brown communities. And I would say, though, many of the teachers who are of all backgrounds have been fighting, and a lot of white teachers have been fighting for their students. So really, it's a pretty remarkable multiracial movement in Los Angeles. And I think we should expect that type of support to continue.
Well, Eric Blank, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Great. Thanks so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Eric Blank, who's a former high school teacher in the Bay Area who writes on labor movements past and present. He's the author of the new book, Red State Revolt, The Teacher Strike Wave and Working Class Politics. And he has an article at The Guardian, LA's Teachers Can Teach the Working Class About the Power of Labor Strikes, as well as another article at The Nation, LA's Teachers Strike Will Be the Toughest Yet.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Standing along the side of the pickup truck, one more light goes on.